welcome to episode 13 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. I'm Josh Ho, the formerly incarcerated person. Among other things, I'm a freelance writer, a criminal justice reform advocate, and the author of the book, Writing Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Living Hope. Joel.
Hi there, I'm Joel Barson. My background is in supportive and affordable housing, and I'm Josh's protege.
Yes. Whatever that means. In this context, I don't know if you'd want to be my protege.
I'm learning from you. That's all it means. That's okay. Enough.
Yeah. You don't want to become a better incarcerated person or a better critic of...
Just a better person.
Yeah, good. That sounds like a good plan. Yeah. So what are we going to talk about today, Joel?
Equal pay for equal work?
Well, you know, I mean, I think we're probably talking about that a lot, and also just about jobs in prisons and jails.
Yeah. Yeah, we hinted at this in the last episode where we talked about work in the prison food service industry, and you sort of were able to touch on a few of the points that I feel like we're going to open up much more in this episode. You know, getting back to basic issues of fairness, returning to the to one of the main concerns of this entire podcast, which is how folks are prepared for when they leave incarceration. So a lot to cover, and like all the other episodes, in our preparation for it, of course, I was exposed to the radical unfairnesses built into the system.
Yeah, you know, it's tough. You know, I mean, there's really no area, and part of it's because of the way we look at creating prisons and jails as a punitive space.
Right.
Where you kind of more outcome-based, long-term health thinking about how people return is not built into our system very well. I guess I'm trying to say.
So it's been a few episodes since we've brought popular culture into this, but when I think to, you know, what I have access to by way of what employment in prison looks like in my imagination, I think of, you know, what I saw in The Shawshank Redemption.
Well, what do you remember people doing as their jobs in Shawshank? Because Shawshank is strangely one of the more accurate prison movies. It is strangely accurate.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that because I love that movie so much. You know, there were scenes of the laundry. You know, the main character, of course, Tim Robbins, he works as a bookkeeper, tax preparer, and things like that. I guess that was probably a special situation.
Yeah, he had special skills. Although there are people who do some forms of accounting work. Like, there's definitely people who do bookkeeping for the, like, cafeteria.
Really?
Do
those tend
they
to
don't
be?
Have, like, access to money or spending, but...
What is the... what's the hierarchy of preferred jobs in prison?
Well, it really depends on what prison you're at. You know, I mean, some prisons you have one of the factories, like they're called state industries. Mm. And so they make things like you've heard of license plates or, you know, clothes or whatever their thing is. And so some prisons have those. And if you have those, then you might have access to a job that instead of paying you pennies an hour might pay you a dollar an hour or something like that. Those are highly preferred jobs when you can get them. It also takes up your whole day. You go to work every day like a normal, you know, person probably until you go back to your unit. And that's, I mean, there's definitely some differences in security going in and out of the factory and what you can do. But it's, you know, it's sort of like working a, you know, 9-to-5 kind of job.
So, but of course, you know, we talk about this as if it's a privilege to have these jobs. And I think... from what you've told me, you know, in our previous discussions, there are upsides to it, and I think you'll probably open those up, but it's also a kind of forced labor where folks are paid.
It can be. Yeah. I mean, it's a weird deal, because I was going to go to the other ones that you can, you know, like, so you can have that kind of job. You can have a job where you work in food service, for instance. You're going to get paid a little bit more for that if you work in the cafeteria. Mm-hmm. Not a lot more. You can get paid as a tutor, which we'll talk about a little bit more later, which is an interesting, weird kind of thing that's built into the system. You've got, you know, and then you've got like janitorial, you know, and you've got other, you know, otherly abled helpers, librarians, law librarians, things like that. So there's a bunch of those different kinds of jobs. But what was the question again? I'm sorry.
Well, you know, it seems like there's this balance between the opportunity to be engaged in constructive activity that would seem to be both something that could be good preparation for leaving prison and also just healthy, but on the other side, essentially slave labor.
Well, I mean, I think the answer people would have to that, not me, but, you know, yeah. I mean, if I were playing the devil's advocate, is that it's not forced, really. There, for, at some level it is, because if you have a job assignment, you have to do it or you'll get eventually put in the hole. Shoe, solitary, whatever you want to call it. But there are a lot of jobs that you only have to work for, you know, an hour a day. Because they have a lot more people than they have available jobs. And so if you're like a unit janitor, which I was for a good deal of what I was in prison, you really only work because they have three shifts of people. And, you know, they have more, you know, more, you know, we had like 20 people doing janitorial in each of those shifts. And there's just not that much work, you know. Once you get done, you're done, you know. I mean, so it's not, you know, I mean, there are jobs you could do that are like slave labor, but they're also the jobs most people want to have. That doesn't mean it's okay to pay people nothing to do hard work or dangerous work, which I think is what, when you really get into the exploitation problems, that's, I think, the problem is that it's not so much that you're forced to do it. It's that in order to get the good jobs you are, you have to do a lot of really hard work for very little to no money.
These are like the firefighters, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of jobs. I mean, not everybody has like what everyone read about the California firefighters. We'll talk about it in a second. But, you know, there's a lot of jobs like that. And the other thing is you can't qualify for all jobs. Depends on what your crime was.
Okay.
So there are some limitations to who can do what jobs. Sort of an overview of this. There's a Talk Poverty article that kind of gave an overview to this. This is from that article. Last week, I don't know what week that was, a Louisiana sheriff gave a press conference railing against a new prisoner release program because it cost free labor from some good inmates that we use every day to wash cars, to change oil in the cars, and to cook in the kitchen. 2 days later, news broke that up to 40% of the firefighters battling California's outbreak of forest fires are prison inmates working for $2 an hour. Practices like these are disturbingly common. Military gear, ground meat, Starbucks holiday products, and McDonald's uniforms have all been made and are still made with low-wage prison labor. Inmates are exempt from the Fair Labor Standards Act, which requires that workers are paid at least federal minimum wage. That makes it completely legal for states to exploit inmates for free or cheap labor. More than half of the 1.5 million people in state and federal prisons work while incarcerated, and the vast majority only make a few cents per hour.
This, you know, something you said as you read that went by pretty fast, but sort of struck me as something that I don't think I quite realized before, which is maybe I understood that there were folks working in the laundry and in food service.
Oh, laundry's also a good job. I forgot that earlier.
Oh, okay. And making license plates or whatnot. But you, in this quote from the article on Talk Poverty, you mentioned private companies that are manufacturing products using prison labor. You mentioned Starbucks and McDonald's.
Yep.
So they're using this low-wage labor to make products that they're selling at retail prices?
Right. So when you wonder why McDonald's has so much stuff on their dollar menu, that might be part of why.
Wow. Capitalism knows no boundaries.
Well, and I think we've come back to this theme over and over again, the idea that that what really seems to matter is providing low cost regardless of the cost to human beings.
Right. Is there anything else, Josh, before we go deeper into this about your experience of employment in prison that you think is worth sharing? Or
well, like I said, I worked primarily as a janitor, which, you know, I mean, it really wasn't that bad of a job, except for a lot of the, I don't know how politely to say this, a lot of the worst things that happen or most distasteful things that happen in prison happen in the bathrooms. So cleaning bathrooms isn't the most glorious job in the world. But, you know, if you can get past that, it's, you know, a relatively simple job. But the reason I want to talk about this is because the why I was a janitor is the important thing. You have to remember, when I went to prison, I had a master's degree in international relations, undergraduate in political science, and I had taught at the university level for 20 years.
Right.
But I could not get a job the entire time I was in prison as a tutor.
Wow.
My one thought as I was going to prison was, at least I'll be able to help people learn like English or to read or do math. And ultimately, I did that on the side, not for any pay or anything, with people I knew in prison. But
why, Josh? Why would that be?
Well, and here's where these things get so screwed up. Tutor jobs are highly prized because they pay a little bit more money and it gives you some status. And so the waiting list is pretty long, and they won't make exceptions based on your qualifications. And if they did, you'd be pushing someone else above you out of the way who'd been waiting longer. And so that would actually cause violence, because you'd basically cost them an opportunity at a job that they wanted.
Right, right. So does that mean you were on that list, and that they were, the years you spent in were not long enough to get to the top of it?
Exactly. I was. And also, the other problem is, every time you move from one prison to another and they move you a lot, you move back to the bottom of the list.
Okay.
And so I moved three times, so I was pushed back to the bottom of the list every time.
So one of the things that this seems like, it seems like we're circling around, is that there is an opportunity in work, in being constructively involved in life and doing things and trying to be productive. And so there are upsides. Right?
Yeah. And like I said, I didn't mind, you know, I mean, I don't, you know, there's nothing wrong with cleaning some bathrooms. There's nothing wrong with, you know, I mean, that's all good. I just felt like It was an opportunity. An opportunity costed me washing bathrooms, as I couldn't teach people, and right. I have some skills.
And in part, this is contrasted against dead time, right?
Yeah, you know, like I said, a lot of the jobs in prisons and jails don't give you. There just aren't as many jobs as there are people, and so you have very little time that you have to work. And unless you're in some of the, like, the factory jobs, which is more of a 9-to-5 kind of situation. And so unit laundry guys or girls, that's actually a really well-paying job, because you get subsidized by the people you do the laundry for.
Mm-hmm.
So in addition to the amount of money you make from the state, you also get paid by the people who are in your cadre. And so they actually work a lot of hours every day, but they get really good pay.
Oh, wow.
But they're really highly prized jobs, and it's very hard to get those jobs.
Okay.
You usually have to be picked to be in to get those jobs by the other laundry people.
Okay.
And it usually takes some time. But for most people, I think the vast majority of people, you might work, you know, an hour a day, or might not even have a job. And so there's a ton of dead time. And, you know, it's tough when you got nothing, literally nothing to do all day, every day.
So, you know, in the article about the firefighters, it mentions that a California firefighter makes $40,000 a year, whereas an inmate doing that same work might make $500 a year.
Yeah, so, I mean, we keep returning to this firefighters thing, and I think that's because the California wildfires last year were so extreme, and actually for years, decades... inmates have been helping people fight the forest fires in California. It's kind of a bittersweet tale, though, because it's very dangerous work, obviously, because you're fighting fires.
Right.
They don't really get the same amount of training as a firefighter gets, and they get paid a lot less, but they take all the same risks. Go ahead.
And is there something about them also not being employable after?
Yeah, the really bittersweet thing about this is, in California, they won't hire you as a firefighter if you have a felony background. So you're literally learning a skill that you won't be able to use as long as you live in California. I don't know if other states are the same or not.
Learning a skill and putting your life on the line.
Yeah. Pretty ridiculous.
Yeah. And on the spectrum of ridiculousness, can you help me understand the Whole Foods situation?
Well, I mean, they stopped doing it, but for a long time, Whole Foods was essentially subcontracting out prisons to prepare some of their fish, like what we were talking about with McDonald's before. And if anyone watches Orange is the New Black, which I do bring this up because I did, you know, I wrote a recap of every episode of that whole series, all, I think it's 65 episodes. And there was a subplot on there where an undergarment manufacturer had had subcontracted with the prison, and with Litchfield in that case, and they all, a lot of the inmates worked at that, making basically underwear.
And Whole Foods, as we all know, is not a company that has a dollar menu, as you said, for McDonald's. It's what can I say about how expensive it is to shop there, and yeah, it's dispiriting that they use prison labor.
It's the home of the $5 cookie.
Right, that's exactly it. So it is this interesting balance between the opportunity to be active versus being exploited. I don't know how it's resolved. What is the ideal situation?
Well, I mean, I think for me, this is a false dilemma.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is you'll usually see articles, you'll see one person saying, this is slavery labor, it's exploitative.
Where I started. Yeah.
And then you'll see another article from someone who's like, I was an inmate, and I appreciated the opportunity not to have dead time.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Both of those things can be true.
Right.
Okay, you can enjoy that you're not sitting doing nothing all day, and also be exploited.
Right.
And there's really no reason why, and we'll talk about this when we get to solutions, but there's really no reason why you can't both provide opportunity and make sure that the journey that you take in that opportunity ultimately sets you up for a better outcome when you're released from prison, which I think is I think most of the complaining would stop in a world in which, whatever the situation, the person who was doing the work had any real expectation that that work would result in some better opportunity for employment when they get out. And, you know, I mean, I remember having a discussion with one of the people at the Michigan Department of Corrections about, you know, making sure that every single inmate in the Michigan system at least left prison with soft skills. And they said, their answer to me was, we already give them soft skills, they have jobs. And I was like, man, I had those jobs. Right. You don't learn. Basically, I learned how to mop and how to clean a shower.
Right.
How did that teach me soft skills or interview skills? You know, I mean, that doesn't make any sense to me. But that's the kind of, you know, that's really kind of the way that goes.
It would seem that it's a missed opportunity to have a sort of supportive employment situation where these experiences are gainful for their post incarceration lives, and therefore good for all of us.
Yeah, I think one of my core beliefs is that we should start, that if prisons and jails were to be run correctly, the administration would start planning for someone's successful return to their communities the moment they arrived in prison or jail. And really before that, from the moment they were sentenced.
That sounds like a pretty sensible framework.
And I always, the analogy I draw is to hospitals. When you go to a hospital, they're already preparing for how to get you home before you even get put in your bed.
Right. Right. I like that. That's very helpful. So what about solutions, Josh?
Well, you know, this is something I have so much, you know, we'll talk about this again when we get done with prison and we're talking about reentry.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think one of the first things, and I've talked about this before, is that there is no reason, one of the biggest powers that a prison or a jail has is their contracting power.
Right.
And basically all of these companies that essentially exploit prisoners, and I don't mind saying that for like JPay or mm-hmm. or Keefe or Aramark or any of those Trinity, Securus. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like they are exploitative. I've done the research. I know what they charge. I lived through it. Mm-hmm. I think they are exploitative. And mm-hmm. I think that at the very least, the price of admission for those companies to get to exploit prisoners and their families should be the requirement that they train inmates. They find some, they work to train inmates in a service that can then be hired when inmates leave, and that every single damn one of those companies, if they contract with the Department of Communications, and I mean this, every single one of those companies should have to hire formerly incarcerated people, period.
It's absurd that that doesn't happen. Is there nowhere in this country that is a model for that? Does it happen anywhere?
I wish I knew. I mean, there's some instances, certainly, where there is wraparound kind of, you know, with particular companies. And we'll talk about one of the ones that's happening in Michigan in a second. It's not companies, it's unions. But, you know, to me, that's just, you should not have a contract. If you're a Department of Corrections, you should not have a contract with anyone. And I mean, zero people that A, do not help inmates in the inside learn skills, and B, They don't hire inmates on the way out. That's just...
it's patently absurd.
It just makes no sense to me the way that we, you know, it's literally letting them get away with murder. You know, yeah. I mean, okay, not literally, yeah. And, figuratively, and not murder probably, yeah. But still, it's terrible.
It is.
Okay, and I already talked about how I think it should be a 360 process. Mm-hmm. One of the suggestions you see people make a lot is this idea of paid apprenticeships. And I think that's a decent idea. I actually think it would be okay with me, and I'm not the ultimate arbiter, but me, that you paid less wages, as I said before, if you were training someone in a skill that then they could carry out and have the ability to get hired immediately with that. So, you know, they have gotten to a level of skills that they were able to. Now, there are some problems with this, and that is that apprenticeships tend to be very intensive and tend to only help certain people. For instance, in Michigan, we have a program that's gotten an awful lot of press called Vocational Village. And I've met with the head of the Department of Corrections in Michigan, Heidi Washington. I've talked to Chris Getz, who's the PR guy for, you know, I have talked to them about this a lot. I think generally it's a pretty good idea. Basically what they've done is they've partnered with trade unions. Mm-hmm. To help trade people in skilled labor, mm-hmm. So that they can then be union members when they get out and get union jobs. Mm-hmm. It's a great idea.
That sounds like a great idea.
The problem is, as currently constructed, it serves between 200 and 400 of the 39,000 inmates in Michigan. And so a lot of our reentry funds in prison, or a lot of our training funds, go to this one program that doesn't serve the vast majority, the overwhelming majority of the inmates in the prison.
It sounds like you have a better chance of hitting the lottery.
Yeah, and there's also the same carve-outs. Only certain people can be in it. Well, yeah. No, that's not actually true. They did say that they will take people. It has to be, you have to be a certain, there are requirements, but they're not the usual requirements. I apologize for that. But you know, if there was a world in which these apprenticeships could be applicable to a larger number of people, or they had a diversity of these kind of apprenticeships, or for goodness sake, some companies came in and started to actually create these apprenticeships so that the DOC didn't have to pay for the process of making the apprenticeship available, then maybe we'd have, or universities. I've talked about this a lot. It's shocking to me that the University of Michigan, for instance, or Michigan State University in our state, which are both very big research institutions with lots of funding and gigantic endowments, aren't leading the way on training or finding ways to do inreach into prisons, what we call inreach, to train inmates and populations. So again, I think this paid apprenticeship is a good idea. Mm-hmm. I think the problem with it is it ends up being very cost intensive and doesn't serve a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If there was a way to break it open so that more people had access to it,
yeah.
I would be all for it and think it was one of the best things since sliced bread.
Yeah, hear, hear. Agreed.
I think another thing is to make sure that every single person who goes to prison or jail is trained in soft skills. Mm-hmm. One of the things we talked about on JPay is if they're giving these tablets out, they should for darn sure have a lot of these educational programs that people should they should have to participate in. Mm-hmm. In the instance of soft skills, they should have a program that mm-hmm. you know is designed to help people get better at, for instance, their interviewing skills or their, you know, whatever proficiencies the state thinks or ends up feeling is necessary for. So anyway, I think that's pretty good. I think it's really important. Currently, what happens in prison is the amount of training you get is literally limited to a very small number of things. You've got janitorial. Mm-hmm. And the janitorial you learn in there is not as extensive as perhaps the janitorial you would need to get a good job on the outside as a janitor. Food prep, and as we said in the last episode, they could do a lot to try to make it so it's more of a professional preparation for food services. Mm-hmm. And you know, and like making license plates. What are they going to? I mean, people right. don't get out of prison and go to the license plate factory because the license plate factory is in prison. So right. you know, I mean, it's not a you're not learning a skill. You're getting paid to do a job for them.
Yeah.
And so I think it's important that they expand beyond this. There are some examples of this. There are some states that, for instance, have started to teach people programming.
Yes.
Which is a next economy skill that, yeah. you know, and I think where they need to do more of that. I yeah. think they need to use the things like the tablets that they're bringing to these prisons, and they need to insist that people get next economy training on those tablets and that they start to create opportunities for next economy jobs. And I think, you know, well, there's no reason why companies like Google, you know, I mean, why is JPay the so-called Apple of incarceration? Why isn't Google going into prisons and teaching programming or making sure that people have access to educational materials? Or, I mean, why is that? Why are we letting a purely for-profit and to some extent extorting company, I mean excessively feed company, come in there and do that when there are companies that are well situated to yeah. do it and have at least showed interest? Google has spoken at length. They had a conference not too long ago about their interest in solving mass incarceration. So if that's an interest to them, they should probably get involved in it, I would think.
A shout out here to one of my favorite programs, which is Slack. The Slack company, for those who use Slack, donates 100% of their profits from their store to teaching programming in San Quentin.
Nice.
Yeah.
Good for them.
Yeah.
See, more people need to do that.
And more people need to use Slack.
Apparently, although to date, we have been on Slack and you have yet to make me even suggest how I'm supposed to use it.
We'll get
even
there.
Though you said it was an important part of this podcast, or would be. Sorry, getting off the topic. Yeah. So the last thing I want to talk about is a kind of crazy idea I've had for a long time. There's not a lot of literature on it. I kind of made it up. I'm going to be honest with you. Well, no, I saw one person refer to it once, and I don't even remember what article that was. I'll try to find it and put it in the notes. But it was a long time ago. But I kind of took the ball and ran with it. I believe that this firefighters thing we were talking about is a really good example. And let me say one other thing about that firefighter before we move on, mm-hmm. is that there's a... the first time I ever read about it was in this New York Times article, and that you know they basically told the story of this one girl, and you know really went into her background and really went into her story and kind of a minor crime, you know, it was personal drug use, not selling or anything like that. Although I obviously don't care either way, I'm just saying this was her story. She gets put in. She ends up just a couple weeks before she's going to be released, dying doing the firefighting. Her name was Shauna Lynn Jones, and just seemed like a super person, you know, really had a lot of friends. And you just think, you know, a lot of these jobs in that are being asked, you know, there are dangers to them. And all we're really saying is that these people deserve to be treated as if they were, you know, human and worth the care.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that, but I think that this firefighters thing is kind of the tip of the iceberg. And what I mean by that is, and that's a little bit of a joke, mm-hmm. is that with global warming and our kind of universal infrastructure failure, that one of the things that every state in the union is facing right now is incredible needs for a cadre of people who are capable of going out and fixing a lot of those problems.
Right. Yeah.
It would make a lot of sense to me, since the state's going to have to pay someone to do it anyway, for the state to start training people inside prisons to do remediation and infrastructure repair. And at the end of the day, that then become, then the state should also start a cadre that more or less that's what they do. And I think this is unique in another way, because one of the problems as we end mass incarceration and decrease the amount of prisons is we have a lot of people who worked in corrections who don't have jobs anymore.
Mm-hmm.
This is a place where they could land too. And there's something to me that is really poetic about finding ways for inmates and correctional officers and all the different people who are put in this terrible economic system called called incarceration,
mm-hmm.
with all the perverse incentives and all the moral hazards and all the things, to actually end up working together to try to solve problems for the state,
right.
Which is, when you think about it, you know, what is more, what would be better than having committed a crime in a state and then literally helping that state recover? I don't know. It just seems, it seems too good to ever happen in my own head.
It's a beautiful idea, though, Josh. I love it. And I appreciate you bringing global warming into it. I mean, that's something that...
well, that's why those firefighters... I mean, that's why there's so many more fires probably in California right now. I know someone who's a global warming skeptic will probably jump at me on that. That's fine. I mean, I'll take the slings and arrows on that one.
Yeah. I love that idea. I think it's very profound. Any other suggestions, or does that exhaust our list for now?
Well, I don't want to go, you know, because ultimately what we're, you know, we're also going to have a reentry one, and we got, you know, I mean, but I do want to say that it's very important in my mind that while people are in prison, that we look at that as an opportunity.
Right.
And we look at that as a chance to create not just good outcomes, but a better society, you know, all the way around, you know, a chance for people to come back and make a difference, a chance for people to come back. Sometimes people who've never had anything or never felt valued or never felt that they can come back and actually feel a part of a community. And as we've said before, you know, I mean, the three biggest triggers of recidivism, you know, are lack of employment, lack of housing, and lack of community connection. And the more we can encourage those three things as part of the process of incarceration, you know, healing those things, making solutions for those things, the better. And the more we can look at prison and jail not as just a place to house people as they're being punished for whatever they did, but also as a chance to change those lives and to change society in a way that the whole process on every possible way is made better, you know, is, for me, profound.
I think it is too, Josh. That sounds like the world I want to live into. I hope we get there.
So did you have any thought, anything in particular jump out at you in your last thoughts today?
This is a lot, and I, you know, you've often said in previous episodes, and I think this is really the thread that went through that, that last little soliloquy you had there, which is that lots of these folks, most of them, are going to come back out, and we should want that to be part of improving our world. And I don't know, I hope someone listening to this is able to have their heart changed by listening to you.
Yeah, and I want to say as my last thought, a little over a week ago, maybe it was a week ago, I spoke at the prison, at an art show of work of incarcerated people, people who are currently in prison. Every year, a group called PCAP, which is the Prison Creatives Arts Project in Michigan, puts out a show together of art by incarcerated people. And one of the things that I said when I spoke at the end of that, which was a real honor for me, because it's one of the few shows where the people who are the artists in prison actually get to see the tape of all the speeches and get to see the show. So it was a real honor for me. One of the things that I said, and I think deeply believe, is that it would be impossible to go to that show and look at the art on the wall without realizing how much more each of those people are than their crime.
Yeah. Amen.
And that those are human beings with feelings and hopes and dreams and sadness. And just like everybody else, they want the same things, you know. And if you make that connection, you know, if you find a way to make that connection, yeah, maybe not through an art show, but through someone wrote a story or whatever, and you make that connection, you know why it's important for us to do these things, like try to find better answers to make sure that when people get out, they have real opportunities. And I just, I can't say enough how much I feel connected to the people that are still inside and how sad I am that we haven't made more progress since I've been out.
Thank you, Josh. That's very moving. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, all right, Joel, another episode down.
Yeah.
All right. Well, on that note, Decarceration Nation is available from iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever podcasts are aggregated. We're now also available on Spotify. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you'll listen to us again next week.